Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean Delaney, a board-certified veterinary nutritionist whose company, Balance It, is sought after by pet owners and veterinarians across the world for advice about personalized, optimal nutrition. This show offers well-researched, objective information about pet nutrition, from home cooking to the pet food industry, so you can make thoughtful decisions about feeding your own dogs and cats. This show is a production of Eight Paws LLC and DVM Consulting, Inc., which are solely responsible for its content. The Radio Pet Lady Network is brought to you in part by Spot Platinum, an allergy test to find out what in your dog's environment or diet may be causing his scratching or licking. Allergies for which Spot Platinum can make a USDA-approved serum, custom-tailored to your dog's specific needs to control his symptoms. Spot Platinum is a privately owned company that has done more than 500,000 allergy tests over 25 years. For more information, visit them on the web at www.vetallergy.com. This show is also brought to you by Meow Space, a clear ventilated enclosure that can be a one cat feeding space, a litter box station, or even a safe place to nap, designed so that only one cat with a unique access device can enter the see-through box. Meow Space is made in the USA to solve out-of-litter box problems and individualized feeding needs in multi-cat households. Big enough for large cats to do their business or small dogs to eat their food in peace, Meow Space benefits the whole family because it keeps dogs and small children out of the litter box, too. Go to meowspace.biz. That's meowspace.biz to see for yourself. Dr. Sean, here we are again, back at our microphones, and we sort of left everyone on tenterhooks about what was the Purina Blue Buffalo lawsuit? What was the lawsuit about? We talked about the difference in the sizes of these companies, and all the companies are way bigger than we can kind of wrap our heads around. But it was around the issue of Blue Buffalo taking ads. I believe it was the television ads, but also the print ads that said, you should check your food. I don't know if they specifically called out Purina, because we don't have chicken byproduct meal in our food, and so you shouldn't eat that other food. Was that sort of what their ad said?
That was basically the gist of it. I only saw it actually a couple times. I don't watch a lot of live television personally, and I don't have cable, so I'm not the most, I guess, well aware of their ads. I know that Saturday Night Live actually made a spoof that was basically a Blue Buffalo-esque video, which was pretty interesting. But in any event, I think the positioning of Blue Buffalo, and don't want to speak for them, but is really, you know, about the fact that there's certain things that they would not use in their food, and were very adamant about it, and by extension suggested that these were things that you would be very worried about if you really knew they were in there, and you should look at the label. And they had ways of, I think, pulling up and having like check marks about what they don't have or do have, and both on, I've seen on the internet, and then obviously, as you point out, TV ads. And I believe the lawsuit was around $50 million for
it was not it was
year.
Not trivial.
Yeah, that they had spent like $50 million on advertising that was, you know, misleading or false, and I think specifically indicating that their products were superior based on, including Purina, for example, based on the fact they didn't use the chicken byproduct. And then Purina came out and sued them and said that they had analyzed some of the Blue Buffalo products and specifically found pretty high inclusions, you know, in around 20-24% with poultry byproduct meal and eggshell and raw feathers would all indicate that they were
using. It's rather shocking. So on the first part, I'm sorry, go ahead. I mean, I just want to make this clear to people. They were saying you should never compare our food to anybody else's, but I guess especially Purina. We would never put this awful thing, the implication, this awful thing in our food. And really the question was, in a sense, well, why is it so awful? And then to discover that a huge part of their food had that very thing in it.
Right, at least some of the foods. And I think they called out, you know, specific brands. So, you know, whether it was widespread, I don't think that was suggested. But, you know, they were suggesting that none of their foods had it. So that was what Purina, you know, took them to court with. And then kind of as a revelation, as they worked through this, and I think discovery, I think is the term they use, apparently, and this came out about mid-October, that Blue Buffalo had to admit that one of their suppliers, I think it's called Wilbur Ellis, which is a San Francisco-based company, out of one of their, I think, Texas facilities was actually supplying the very thing that they weren't supposed to. And I don't know where it's gone, of whether it was with knowledge on Blue Buffalo part or not. I think that's what's being worked through, and obviously has significant ramifications depending on how that all works out.
But it's big time, excuse the expression, egg on their face anyway.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the challenge really becomes is that, you know, if you're positioning yourself as being superior, and it's superior based on the avoidance of certain
yes.
ingredients, and then you get called out by your competitor and you say that that's impossible and it didn't happen. And then when things are looked into more closely with the, I guess, a lawsuit, that you discover that that isn't the case, it really becomes challenging, I think, for the company.
Well, I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about in a previous show about there being pack companies that make foods for other companies. And in the big crisis in the pet food world of the melamine, the toxic melamine that was entered into the food stream of many brands because one big place made a lot of those foods, I guess that speaks to a company like Blue Buffalo that, unlike a really smaller company that has a closer eye on where and how things are being made, the bigger a company gets, the less of that oversight, I would guess, you can really have.
I don't know if I would characterize that. I think what I would say is that you always have to know your supplier and your relationship with them. And this is a supplier, not a co-manufacturer, I believe,
okay.
in this particular case. So the difference for the audience, if you will, is a supplier would be someone who would provide you a raw material. In this case, we're talking about chicken byproduct versus someone who is going to physically make it for you with ingredients you've purchased maybe from suppliers.
Right.
And so I think that you always have to have a good relationship. And we've talked about this in past shows about understanding that relationship. But what I do think is interesting is that I think that we always have to recognize there is an inherent struggle with our desire to get more for our money. And when folks are putting pressure, downward pressure on price, but demanding very high quality, there is the potential for something to give. And I think that one of the struggles, I would imagine, is that as you grow, and I'm not saying any particular company, you are always looking to try to maintain your margins and to get volume discounting, and you can potentially put pressure on your supplier to control your costs. And that sometimes can be a problem, because if your supplier is forced with that, either they can be in a situation where it's going to become very difficult for them to make any money supplying what you're asking for at the price that you're willing to pay them for. And if the supplier is now beholden to the buyer because they're a major part of their business, that can create a delicate situation. And I think you add into that situation the potential that if you request for certain ingredients and the world's supply is not adequate to meet that, how do you then also address that? And so when you were very small and you said, hey, I really want to get this unique ingredient or the special ingredient, you may have been able to find enough supply. So both supply and what you're willing to pay for that supply can become in conflict with success. And I know I'm speaking in very broad generalities, but I think that I don't know enough specifics. I've only read the popular press. I'm not involved with either company at all, so to be able to comment specifically what happened in this scenario. But having been in the industry, I think that that can be a challenge at times.
And then you get to another layer of a different kind of egg on face, where then the Blue Buffalo company said that somebody said byproduct meal poses no quote unquote health, safety, or nutrition issue. So then why do they make such a big deal in the marketing
right.
about excluding it? I mean, I know that when I wrote and researched the Dog Bible, that byproducts in general, the use of them in big commercialization of food, could represent some lousy things in the food chain. some guts, some feathers, some feces and stuff. The byproducts themselves aren't necessarily bad at all. Organ meats are fabulous. Liver is divine. But those aren't the parts that are used in a byproduct meal. Whereas a chicken meal, again, there's very strict rules that you know and can cite them out of the book where they're described.
And we've read those in past shows and stuff.
Yes.
And I personally don't have any problem. Now, I obviously make a couple of dry foods. We don't use byproduct because that's the space, if you will, that we sell in, and you just don't use those ingredients. But in order to do that, you have to be very, very careful, and you have to actually, you know, pay for what you're getting and
make sure that you got what you paid for, because you may not even, it's not like it visually looks different when it's all ground up into a meal.
It can, actually.
Oh, does it?
Yeah. So, for example, you know, when we were producing our catfish and our pork, it came, you know, and we had to homogenize it. That's a fancy word by you basically make it like the consistency of what you would put in a hot dog casing.
Okay.
And so there's special machines that cut the meat up, if you will, and the fat that's in there. And it, what's interesting is that color will change depending on what's in there. So, for example, as you would expect with pork meat, it was very pink. If with the catfish, because it was, you know, all supposed to be and was flesh, it was very, very white. Well, if you start putting in organ meat, you're going to get pink coloring that's starting to come into all this. And depending on fat and protein level, you can start to see just color variation because of that. So it's not perfect, but it's not like you could be... it would have more questions if all of a sudden you've been getting catfish, you know, and all of a sudden when you look at it, it's become pink when it's been a whitish gray.
Right. You know, something is going on, and it's not just some seasonal thing that happens to catfish.
And I don't want to blame Blue Buffalo, because if they were lied to and they were paying a premium from their supplier,
that's true.
Then that, you know, that is, you know, unfortunate, and something that they're going to take up probably in a separate lawsuit with their supplier.
That's a good point. Again, the lawyers get fat while the dogs get lean. I mean, the company Halo that I work with, and it's been a sponsor of some of my shows for a long time, they pride themselves on saying they use no meal of any kind, but they have to be very, very careful. Before this lawsuit, they were made aware of being very careful that in saying they don't use meal, that they're not implying that someone who does is a bad guy, or that there's anything necessarily bad about it. In other words, they have to almost use that as a disclaimer. We don't do it, but okay, if you want to, it's okay, because people are very tetchy.
Well, and I think that I guess my approach, and I don't know the folks at Halo, but, you know, in companies that I have dealt with in the past, I think that you can have a different philosophy and find market and find people who want to buy from you without beating up on others.
Absolutely.
And I think the challenge in this particular case is that they were so out front with suggesting that there was something wrong, that when they got called out on having it in their very food, and then, as you pointed out, then saying, well, it's perfectly fine, safe, it was unfortunate in the sense that it was different with what they had been proclaiming and positioning themselves as. I think it's a reminder to everyone in the industry, ultimately, that it's important to know your supplier. I think it's important to be checking for quality and do third-party testing and being aware and recognizing that sometimes if a deal's too good to be true, it probably is, and you have
good
to be
point.
Aware of that. And I think to the pet consumer, I think that you have to realize that if you want all these bells and whistles, I'll call it that, there is a cost with it. And if the product you're buying is not proportionately more expensive, there maybe that should be a question that you're
How can they
raising,
afford to do it?
How is that possible?
In fact, there's a food that had came out a number of years ago, and you look at the ingredients, and it has quail and these other, I think, quail. I can't afford quail. And I even called them up. I said, I'm thinking, where is the quail market that the leftovers are going into a pet food? They said they were raising it somewhere in America, the quail. And I guess they were, but the price was really a gentle price. In fact, it's a food now sold at Tractor Supply, which is not to say anything bad about it, but Tractor Supply also has the lowest end foods that...
It's not a boutique pet food.
Hardly. I mean, you know, it's right next to the aisle for the chicken feed, the rabbit feed, and the goat feed, and the cow feed. So it comes from that tradition of farm food, which was the origin of many of the original pet foods, And therefore, those pet foods have ingredients that we now are...
Is it quail chicks that didn't make it in the production?
It's hard to say. I just, you know, I don't even eat out at fancy restaurants anymore, but how often do you see quail on a menu? How much extra quail could there be?
Well, I just wonder because I was, you know, the world is a funny place, and you have, as we said at our last show, you sit with people and you don't know where the conversation is going to lead. But I'm in an agricultural area, and we don't think of California sometimes that way, but we are a huge agricultural state, and I live around all farmlands where I am out here in Northern California. And so I was at a church gathering, and I was talking to a gentleman, and he said, "Oh, what do you do?" Or what I, you know, we had that conversation you do to start off things as usually. And he's a chicken farmer, but he doesn't do. He raises a variety of very unique species or breeds, maybe is a better word, of chickens. And he says that sometimes they just don't survive. And so. How we got this conversation was I said I had visited the Raptor Center, which is where the University of UC Davis rehabilitates injured, you know, raptors, large birds of prey.
Right.
And they had all these little chicks there, and they were getting them from similar hatcheries. And so I wonder, because unfortunately in life, not everyone makes it to adulthood.
Right.
And so they're perfectly fine. And so I wonder if they had just identified a quail hatchery where the quail didn't quite make it.
Well, but maybe not. You're always so kind and optimistic. But when you point out, I mean, you're like, oh, I'm sure there must be like a billion pounds of quail a year that were just getting lost. And now they're beautifully recycled into a pet food. I would have to say that when you talk about supply and demand and making sure you have something, that would seem like a very iffy supply and demand sort of situation if you've already got all your bags printed.
Years ago, we tried to get camel meat because were told, but in Australia they said, "Oh, we've got so much camel meat." And this is when I was
hilarious.
I don't think I'm revealing anything. So we went down. We could have a novel camel. It's eaten in Middle Eastern countries quite commonly. And
is it? I didn't know that.
Camel's a delicacy.
You eat your transportation.
Well, we used to eat horse meat all the time.
Yeah, true.
And people used oxen a lot. So yep. I guess the answer is yes.
Yeah, you're right.
But so anyway, you know, the camel, we're like, oh, this is going to be novel and it's great. And, you know, and we wanted to find out more. And then they said, yeah, we have so much of it. And then it turned out that it was like the equivalent of a single truckload a year.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Even for a smaller smaller company in Natura size, smaller. And we were talking last time about these billion-dollar corporations and stuff. It was, you know, we would make one production run and then we would be out, and then everyone would be like, why is it back ordered? We want this wonderful camel meat. So, yes, you have to account for that when you start to go down the path. Is there sustainable amounts? I mean, there's a lot of considerations you make in finding a supplier. You know, you're going to do ingredient testing whenever you pick a food because, you know, you have to find out, does it have the right nutrient profile? What is it, the cost of it? Can I get it to my, you know, wherever I'm having it made in a cost effective way? Does it have to be refrigerated or frozen, or does it have to be dehydrated? There's a lot of considerations when you go down and pick a raw material. If it is, you know, something that's been dried, how am I preserving it? You know, what processes does it have to come through? And things that people don't even think about. Where is it going to be handled? Because if I'm going to be selling into Canada or into a country where they have concerns about mad cow disease, it can't be in a facility that's ever handled any ruminant material. There's all sorts of, you know, things you have to consider in the supply chain that, you know, many of these companies have many, many people working every day on that very issue of, do we have enough of it? Can we afford to get it? And I think I've spoken in the past when I was at Natura, when we knew we wanted to switch to using lentils and we were going to be the first really to be using a lot of lentils, we literally had to contract with farmers to plant enough lentils for us to meet our needs. And so it really is something that I think is, someone who goes to the market and just assumes that there's going to be whatever we need. When you get to the level of, you know, these large companies where they're, you know, making tons and tons, literally an hour of food, your demand and how you get that to where it needs to be in a way that it can be used effectively, it really is a challenge.
I remember a long time ago, I said to you, well, isn't meal less good than using the actual flesh of a meat or a fish? And you pointed out something which had never crossed my mind, as many of these concerns that you're talking about right now don't really occur to a pet owner. You said, well, the fish only have a certain season when they're running or growing, and so you have to get them then and then freeze them or dehydrate them or turn them into meal. You can't have access to those fish.
Or when we were developing, we were doing the Evo fish, we were going to use salmon and herring, and
yes,
we wanted to have a specific ratio of N6 to long chain omega-3 fatty acids, EPA and DHA, which we've talked about a lot in the past, and we had decided we had to go with herring oil to supply it because we knew that in order to use as much fresh salmon, we could not solely rely on wild-caught salmon because there is a seasonality to it.
Yes.
And it meant we had to rely on farm fresh. And I remember being presenting at a very large pet food meeting in Las Vegas, and one of the folks that was one of our key retailers or distributors said, why isn't it always wild caught? And then had that very conversation that the reason we like wild caught is for the EPA and DHA, but if we wanted to have a year-round supply, we had to rely on some other sourcing for it, and we weren't going to commit to saying absolutely always use wild caught.
That's right, because then you'll get caught with your pants down. Then you get caught in a situation like this where you're like, oh my God, now what are we going to do? Well, we'll just still hope nobody notices, you know, and it just wouldn't go along with the philosophy of a company trying to be as above board and honest as possible, but planning for the future.
I don't know that the situation with Blue Buffalo, again, they could really have been misled.
Of course.
Pay a premium. And, you know, and that's the challenge, is that inherently, no matter who you are, the smallest company to the biggest company, someone can lie to you and cheat you. And that is unfortunate. And you do everything you can to protect yourself from that. But ultimately, there are always going to be people that are dishonest. There's always going to be people that are going to try to take advantage of a situation. And what your hope is that you work diligently with folks that share your passion, share your desire for quality, for safety, and are going to inherently be honest people.
That goes without saying, but I think there's two other little sort of rules of the road that go along with this. One of them is, if you're going to throw a rock at a glass house, you better have your nose as clean as a whistle. So if you're going to finger point, you better make sure you are so, you know, squeaky clean and on the up and up yourself. And that clearly, there was some sloppiness there. Secondly, something that you said earlier, which I believe in strongly, you don't have to do negative messaging to sell a positive product or a positive message. I totally am against what any of my co-hosts, any of the sponsors on any of my programs, if they say, oh, well, if you feed that commercial food, it causes cancer, or this shampoo is really bad because it could be carcinogenic, or anything negative. All this other stuff is made of chemicals or it's dangerous. It's like, no. You tell me why what you believe in and care about is good, because the person listening will then be impressed by the good, positive message. You don't have to say how bad something else is to say yours is good. And I just do believe that kind of negative messaging is kind of alarmist, and it just doesn't have the right, excuse the expression, karma to go with it.
Yeah, and I mean, everyone has to make the decision how to move forward for them, but I think the best approach is that, is your point, is let's stay positive, let's focus on the good things that you do and how you do it differently, and then let the cards fall as they may. And people are smart. People get
it. Yes, absolutely.
People will make good decisions, and you'll be successful.
Yeah, and people will get what they want at a price they can afford, something you've pointed out repeatedly on the show. There are products made of lesser quality, lower on the feeding chain, if you want to use that expression, ingredients, but so is their price point lower. And not everybody can afford a very expensive dog or cat food. Some people...
And frankly, I don't think that they have to or should, because you know what? I think having a pet is a wonderful human experience.
Yes.
And I think if it can make people have the ability to have a pet at every income bracket, I don't think pet ownership should be the purview or the exclusive right of the rich.
Very much not so. Yes, I agree.
And so I think that we have to keep that, and we've talked about that in the past before, and I don't think we should pass judgment on folks that do the best they can.
That's right. And if they don't know any better, and then they learn about it and they say, God, I'd really like to feed that different food, I can't afford it. I get emails from people.
They feel guilty.
They feel terrible. They say, I have four cats. I can't afford canned food. Well, I've always been saying dry food is kitty crack. It's not good for the obligate carnivore. But, you know, that person's four cats, those are her family. And they matter to her. They matter enough to her that she's writing me an email. She's taking the time to put it out there to someone who's already shown judgmentalism about dry food and said, well, what do I do? Well, that's very, very humbling to me. It's like, well, I have to help you find a solution that will work and keep your cats healthy, but keep them as your cats. Not two are out the door because you can't afford to feed the way, you know, I would say is optimal, or some vets would say is optimal. So there's reality, and then there's, you know, some ivory tower kind of version of things. Fish is just a topic that I'd love to touch on for a minute to finish up the show. The whole issue of farmed versus wild caught. I mean, what are those issues?
I think that the biggest one you see from a nutritionist perspective, and why, you know, you'll see wild-caught suggested so often, is wild-caught, because it's been on natural prey, I'll call it that, and there has been bioaccumulation of these long-chain omega-3 fatty acids, specifically EPA and DHA, which are made by really small little, you know, parts of plants and tiny little microorganisms in the ocean, and then eaten by some other animals, and then eaten by other animals.
Right.
That accumulates in the fatty tissue of these fish. So they'll take the salmon, for example. And so they are really rich in these EPA and DHA, which has wonderful benefits we've talked about for anti-inflammatory properties and all sorts of good health benefits, and for children, for brain and eye development, and puppies and cats. And so the wild caught, why we think about fish as being so healthful, is because largely related to those long chain omega-3 fatty acids. Well, when you have farmed raised, they're farm raised, and they're fed what we would feed farm animals, at least in our conventional sense now, which is very rich, usually at least in the U.S., of corn-based products. And corn is a very rich in N6 fatty acid, linoleic acid specifically. And so their bodies accumulate a lot more N6 fatty acids than would be normal for them if you were catching them out in the ocean. And so farm raised versus wild caught really is a discussion first and foremost in a nutritional perspective about fatty acid profile. There's obviously other concerns. Some people will suggest, well, sometimes farm raised is more sustainable, and there's been a lot of efforts with regard to that. We're not overfishing the population and leading to extinction. Sometimes farm raised will be suggested as a benefit from the perspective of avoiding other bioaccumulated toxins that are now present in our sea. And so if you're concerned, for example, about mercury or dioxins or PCBs or all these things that can unfortunately make their way out into our ocean and then bioaccumulate, just like those fatty acids bioaccumulate, then, you know, this is something that maybe makes farm-raised fish better. And so there's, I think, always, like everything, there's pluses or minuses between the two. Obviously, there's a price point difference where you would expect farm-raised to be much less expensive. But you just have to recognize that you may not be getting the same benefit from a fatty acid perspective that you would if you were feeding and eating wild-caught fish.
But it doesn't make it necessarily bad. It just makes it different, and it has its pros and cons. Just something for people to realize, because there are a lot of foods, or a number of pet foods, dry pet foods I'm thinking of, that have a lot of salmon in them. You have one of catfish. Some have a bit of herring and sardines, right?
And for us, for our catfish, we don't rely on the catfish as a source of N3, because it is going to be farm-raised catfish. That is how catfish are raised. And we're really talking about fresh versus marine. So fresh water doesn't usually have the bioaccumulated EPA and DHA like marine fish do. So trout and some other species don't really have high EPA and DHA levels because of what they eat, not to the same degree.
But
as
they
marine.
Can have toxins. Some of the lake fish, I remember when I was writing my pregnancy book, there's lake fish that the Great Lakes and so forth that are just toxic. I mean, pregnant and people that want to be pregnant and are pregnant shouldn't even eat those fish.
Right, and that is a concern even now, and you'll see recommendations about limiting your fish intake because of mercury, for example, and stuff. But what I was going to say is we rely on herring oil for our EPA and DHA, which is very, very high in that food. And
so
there's, and this similarly can be done in a, you know, anyone's diet or in a pet's diet, is that you can use all sorts of nice products. You know, I'm familiar with, for example, Nordic Naturals, which I think you're very familiar with.
That love
makes
them.
A product. And they have a source of, you know, a great source of fish oil that you can take and add that that into your diet to provide those longer chain omega-3 fatty acids that you may not be getting because you are using farm-raised fish.
Or because a lot of the other foods that we're eating and the other oils that we're using, very nice, lovely oils, but they're not the threes. They're the sixes and nines, right?
Right. And I think that you'll see that people have become much more interested in what are considered poor choices when you're home cooking in dog food. And we've talked about this, which are things like olive oil or late coconut oil, which are really low in N6, which is important because linoleic acid is the essential fatty acid that dogs and cats need. So when you're home cooking, you often will want to use something rich in that. But when you're cooking and trying to avoid N6 fatty acids, those things like olive oil and coconut oil are a really nice choice because they aren't adding to the amount of N6 you're putting into your body, and therefore you don't have to have as much N3s to make up for it.
So olive oil is a good thing to use when you're cooking any pet food at home.
It is not if you're using it for the as a source of linoleic acid.
Right.
But if you're using it because you want to add fat or flavoring and you've already met the linoleic acid requirement, then yes, it's a fine source because then you're providing a source that isn't going to counterbalance potentially N3s that you're putting into the diet with your fish oil.
It just
depends what you're trying to achieve.
So your company Balance It has the perfect name and also the perfect supplement, now patented for your use at home, but individualized to each of you, because otherwise you go batty going, but hang on, I thought olive oil was really good for their coat or it's healthy. And yes.
Well, yeah. And I stopped trying to fight that battle because we have 18 different oils and fats you can pick from when you make a diet.
Oh, my goodness.
More than you would probably even think of using.
But wow.
Because people want to have that selection, but you also have to recognize when it will or won't work. And so you want to use coconut oil? Great. You want to use olive oil? Great. You want to use, sunflower, safflower, corn, almond, walnut oil? Here's your options. You can see the effects of whether oil you pick is going to be good or not.
Yes. So those of you that are going the home cooking route, don't even think of going there without going to BalanceIt.com, getting the free information
and advice. Well, they can, because I'm not as a big fan as promoting individual individual benefits to myself. But yes, I think that you want to get guidance about what oils you use if you're home cooking or you're adding in, to make sure that whatever you're adding in isn't causing harm and is actually doing what you're trying to achieve. Because if you're trying to make the coat look better because you think there's not enough fatty acids,
right.
Putting in olive oil may be a bad choice.
That's right. And that's something that I never knew either. Oh, I'll put a splash of olive oil in every dish before I learned about omega-3 fatty acids and Nordic Naturals. It was like, oh, a splash of olive oil in every meal seemed like such a good idea. And how generous of me to use olive oil and not some crummy vegetable oil.
Sure, it's extra virgin as well.
Exactly. Cold-pressed, first pressing. But the truth is that the truth comes out if you go to BalanceIt.com. And I do think it's a great thing for people to know about. There are people who maybe they're going to feed mostly commercial pet food, but maybe they want to serve one meal a day that's home-cooked, or have a week when they're off and they want to home-cook. And they don't know where to begin. And it shows you how to start, middle, and end, and feel comfortable about what you're doing. Dr. Sean, as ever, thank you so much. We'll be back soon with more from the Pet Food Trenches.